drinking too much alcohol, you know, smoking, etc. Those are hard habits to kick, really hard. And then you might even add trauma, like the hijacking of the mind by trauma. And maybe the pathway to healing is through awe and transcendence.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values. We are in a special series of the podcast themed around my book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. And so every episode, which as usual is a deep dive interview about the guests' values and principles and their story, is also connected to one of the seven deadly sins, which is how I structure the chapters in that book. And I'm trying to reflect with the guest on all of these sources of disconnection, which is how I define sin, and what we might instead want to be moving towards. And for this episode, I was thinking about gluttony and what I see as its opposite, or maybe the medicine for it, which is awe, ecstasy, and transcendence. And it was a huge privilege, therefore, to get to talk to perhaps the world expert in awe. In fact, the world expert in many of our deep human emotions, Dacca Keltner. Dacca is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. Berkeley Square in the UK. Berkeley, I'm pretty sure it's Berkeley. He's the author of too many books and academic articles to mention, but I will point you to the book that is also called Awe and also to The Power Paradox, which we didn't get to talk too much about today, but I found really, really compelling. We spoke about his childhood growing up in the 1960s counterculture in California. We spoke about why we feel awe in moments of moral beauty and what moral beauty might even mean. We asked whether human beings can flourish without religion. As usual, there are some reflections, some thoughts from me at the end, but meanwhile, I really hope you enjoy listening. Dacca, I'm going to ask you a question that I think you will probably have given more thought to than almost anyone I could ask it, which is, what does fully aliveness mean to you?
I think fully aliveness means when you understand and embody and enact relationships to things that are bigger than yourself that you really care about, you know, be it a social movement or a pattern of affection in family or a piece of music or the ecosystem around you. I think that fully feeling alive is about just this deep sense of connectedness to the vast forces that make up the world.
And is there one more reliable way for you? And obviously one of the things we could say is that it's sounding very close to your definition of awe. You know, what is the reliable way you can find to have that sense of connection with something bigger than yourself?
Yeah, you know, it's and it was instructive to do the work on awe, but I think that, you know, being fully alive, feeling alive with purpose and meaning and understanding about why we're here, is bigger than awe. And for me, I really look for moments in the day where I feel it. And it has to do with relating to nature. So, you know, just on my walks to school at Berkeley, I walk by trees that I care about. I look at clouds. I sense, you know, the spring bloom. And then I would say, secondly, it's really just relating to humanity, the humanity of people. You know, it's interesting, Elizabeth, early in my career, I learned this system for coding facial musculature, and, you know, it's developed by Paul Ekman, and you can code every visible facial muscle movement and configurations of facial muscles. And then I coded, I'm pretty sure, more faces than any human being has ever coded. I became obsessed. And, you know, I learned something about emotion, but what I learned more deeply is just how to look at the face and eyes and sense humanity and then hear the voice. And so I feel fully alive and connected to large things when, you know, I walk by preschool and all the kids are laughing and playing and, you know, just coming alive as human beings. I feel fully alive it connected to larger things when I see suffering, you know, when I see the suffering of the unhoused in the United States, 650,000. We have a lot in Berkeley. And I'm like, man, you know, there is work to do. So for me, connecting to larger things is really about the natural world and then humanity and immersing myself in it.
And possibly relatedly, I'm always interested in people's deep values. Do you have a sense for you of what are your deep guiding principles, the values that you have at least tried to let define your life?
Yeah, I mean, it you know, it's been an interesting period of discovery or, you know, I was raised by parents who, you know, late 60s and activists and both of them in different ways to the present day. And, you know, I kind of sense the overwhelming power of their values of caring about justice for, you know, civil rights and African Americans. And I would say, you know, for me, it's one is caring. You know, I remember 20 years ago or so, being on a panel with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I was interested in Buddhism, Taoism, and Eastern thought, like a lot of people. And just hearing, you know, he's like, you know, the fundamental commitment is compassion, is care. And that, you know, and then I did a lot of research on compassion, its evolutionary history, its how it affects our nervous systems, how, man, if you can stay close to that, you'll navigate most situations pretty well. And I felt that in my upbringing too, you know, just tracing it back to my parents. And then, you know, more recently, in particular, you know, doing a lot of work with people in prison, the formerly incarcerated, like justice, like the American justice system is brutal and racist in many ways and unfair. And, you know, so that just awakened in me. I think a lot of people will feel this core value through their life and then something that awakens in the middle of life. And justice really awakened in me, you know, in the past 12, 15 years. So I'd say those two.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's quite a lot of thinking in the last few years in terms of this, yes, this midlife turn. You know, David Brooks calls it the second mountain, the kind of shift from achievement to purpose. And I hadn't really thought that, you know, there are these clarifying moments for our values, aren't these moments of moral profundity when we have a kid or we get a bad diagnosis or we have a brush with mortality.
Well, it was amplified with my brother getting sick, you know. That was a really deep experience because, you know, I was an older brother to Rolf, my younger brother, who was 1 year younger. And we just were so close and did a lot together. And in many ways, he was more of my moral compass. You know, he taught really poor kids how to talk. And, you know, he just was just this very principal guy. And when he passed away, I lost my mooring, you know, or my bearings. And it was this period of like, what do I really care about? What should animate my life? So it was also that event that brought me to caring and justice.
Thank you. Well, we're going to come back to that, but I want to just hear a little bit more about your childhood, if that's okay. And unpacking what those principles that your parents held meant for how you lived. Paint me a picture of you and your brother and the life, maybe in your primary school years.
Yeah. Thank you, Elizabeth. You know, when you suffer a trauma, like, you know, a beloved brother passes away, and when your parents get older, you know, my parents are both 86, you know, that's old. You really, you know, and I think that the combination of those two things made me think, man, you know, this little family I grew up in is not vanishing, but it's transforming. You know, it's my brother's gone, et cetera. So I thought a lot about my childhood and family. And, you know, I guess the way to summarize it is I think we were an experiment in alternative culture. You know, I was born in Mexico in a little clinic in 1961, which is unusual, as was my brother. And then You know, we moved to Southern California, and until I was 10, you know, my dad's an artist. My mom was getting a PhD at UCLA to teach romanticism and poetry and Virginia Woolf. So I was raised in the arts, although I was more science oriented. And you know, I've been thinking a lot about it. And I think that I was part of a counterculture, you know, which is everything that my family did in my childhood was almost, you know, the antithesis of sort of standard culture. My mom became the primary breadwinner. You know, my dad was a visual artist critiquing society. You know, my brother and I had really long hair in a place where no one had long hair. We moved in when I was 10 years old to a poor rural town, which was very conservative, where Trump voters would arise today. My parents were these super lefty, you know, they represented George McGovern. So it was just always, I felt like, man, and a lot of people feel this way, like my life is about being a counterpoint to prevailing mm-hmm. culture. And then I would say, you know, what my childhood was like was full of wonder, you know. It was free. My brother and I skateboarded around the Laurel Canyon Hills. People were doing crazy things. We were watching these adults take drugs and, you know, do alternative things. And we were like, wow, look at society. Mm-hmm. You know, when we moved to the country in the foothills of the Sierras when I was 10, you know, we wandered and we went to rivers and we swam and we didn't do homework. And, you know, it was just pretty unconstrained and wild and unconventional. And to be honest, you know, Elizabeth, man, I look at the mental health crises today in young people. I'm like, I am so grateful that I had that freeform childhood.
And I'm not sure if you've addressed this directly, but from various things you said, I got the impression that you maybe lived in a more sort of communitarian or collaborative setup for parts of that period. Is that right?
I think, you know, it's hard to do in the United States because we're so confined to, like, we all live in our individual homes. But yeah, there was definitely this spirit that I was a child of, you know, the discourse around the women's movement and, you know, empowered women. And my mom was a very empowered woman. I was a child in the late 60s of the sexual revolution. And, you know, you couldn't help but sense, you know, wandering, like going to parties of adults and sensing like things are changing. You know, I was a child of, you know, just a really different view of drugs, you know, which cost a lot of kids. I mean, it was hard on kids. I am not very oriented in that way. So you felt, you know, I saw political marches. You felt, as young people feel today, right now in the United States with the attacks on Palestine, you know, that things were in revolution. And we didn't live on a commune. I saw communes. It felt communal. Mm. It just felt like a communitarian spirit, to use your word.
I should kind of confess the sort of personal thing behind the question is that we live in a intentional community, is the jargon.
You're lucky.
Yeah. We're raising our kids in a slightly different way from mainstream society. And ours is influenced more by the kind of monastic heritage and that kind of expression of more communal ways of living than the counterculture one, although these all kind of, you know, learn from each other and feed into each other. So, I'm also always very interested in dominant cultural stories, and the dominant cultural stories about growing up in a counterculture or growing up in a community or growing up in a sect tends to be that the people who had a terrible time, you hear those stories and it's a high risk environment. So reading about your sort of really quite happy sounding childhood outside the mainstream was quite encouraging for me.
Well, no, and I have to say, Elizabeth, I mean, I agree totally. You know, I think, you know, I remember reading Ruth Rosen, a feminist scholar, writing about the late 60s counterculture, and she's like, it ended up reproducing the old patterns of men love the sexual revolution and sexual freedom, you know, and women did all the work yet again, and I sense that. And yeah, you know, I will tell you, and I think a lot about it, like, I think it was my age. I was in the wildest place. I was 8 and 9, right? And so I was an observer, and like a lot of 8 and 9 year olds, they're smart. You know, they're like, look at what people are doing. But I was not 14 or 15. Yeah. And some of the kids who I was around in the Hollywood Hills and Laurel Canyon, where rock and roll was exploding and drugs, man, 14, 15, they got into serious trouble and they did not recover. So yeah, I hear you. I think I got lucky, and that's why I call it an experiment. Yeah. You know, had I been 15, I may have been a heroin addict and, you know, trying to be a rock and roller. Yeah. So it was a risky thing.
And then when you picked up and put in a very different environment, Wikipedia says a conservative town, citation needed, but you have alluded to it too. How do you think that formed you, that experience of being part of a counterculture collectively with other people and then suddenly being the only ones living by a different set of values?
Mm. Yeah, I have to tell you, you know, it's mind-blowing. You know, my mom got a job at a state university, Sacramento State University, to teach as a professor. And we moved, like a lot of kind of counterculture people did, to the country. We got 5 acres and we moved to this really poor rural town at the time, because that's what we could afford. We didn't have much money. And the whole rural thing was a disaster. You know, we didn't get that tractor running and the earth didn't produce good gardens, et cetera. But socioculturally, it was astonishing. And I remember my brother and I arrived with long hair, you know, from LA, and no one had long hair. And the rage around gender stuff was astonishing. I remember going to one of the first days of school and I had a Beatles patch, Sergeant Pepper's patch on my shirt. And kids were like, who are the Beatles? You know, and I was like, whoa. In seventh grade, and this is not a joke, our class was on the Civil War. I represented the North in the debate. And somebody else represented the South, promoting slavery. And my teacher, who was from Tennessee, declared the South the winner.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it was a racist, poor, but very kind people, but they were in that American ideology. And what it taught me to be able to adapt. Right? It taught me to see the underlying humanity of people, you know, that, yeah, this guy, you know, this guy might say racist things, but he, in many ways, he means well, right? And he's trying his best. And that was, you know, I think we've lost sight of that lesson in the United States. And then most importantly, Elizabeth, and I wrote about this in The Power Paradox, it taught me how devastating poverty is for the psyche. You know, 1 in 5 children in the United States is impoverished. They're hungry, and some of the kids I grew up around were like that. A lot of the kids, and I started to see, and now we know this social scientifically that, you know, poverty, you don't have rich educational programs. There aren't wonderful parks, et cetera. Those kids are harmed by that. And I now look back on my past and I see young, promising kids who didn't get a shot because of poverty. And it, you know, the US has been blind to social class and inequality. England got to it earlier, and we're starting to understand it. And I felt it viscerally in my childhood.
Yeah. How would you describe Dacca in his teenage years? What words would you use?
Oh my God. you know, it's interesting. I think there's a layer to my identity that is anxious. So, you know, and, you know, it just runs in my family. I had 4 years of panic attacks. So I look at my teen years and I'm like, oh, I never wanted to go to the big party, et cetera, early in the teens. I think I'm embarrassed. I think I was slightly misanthropic and grouchy, you know, and kind of snarky. And I regret that, you know. I think I've learned how to sort of deal with those demons, if you will. I didn't go to a very good high school. It didn't offer a lot for creative kids or any, you know, so I had good reason to be snarky. I think I was liberated by my brother, who was bolder and more interesting, and then my best friend at the time, Guillermo, Memo, who was wild and, you know, was always pushing me and taught me to be more courageous. So that was good. And then I had a fantasy, probably, you know, generated by my mom, who did write a novel, published, that I'd be a novelist, you know, and turns out I wasn't a very good writer. So I was pretty adrift. It took me a while to find my way.
Do you, it sort of feels, we always do this post-hoc rationalization, right? But it feels obvious to me that given your childhood, you would go study psychology and sociology to try and work out how humans tick.
Yeah.
Was that just an obvious path that opened up before you?
Well, you know, it is. I think the outsider would say yes. I mean, I do feel if I had real talents in the arts or writing fiction, that's what I would have tried to do. But I don't think I really was meant to do that. But I was good at math and science. And, you know, Elizabeth, like now, you know, 50 years later, I mean, 45 years later, when I was 17, you know, I was lucky. My mom was handing me books by D.H. Lawrence and Jung, right? And my dad was getting me to think about Lao Tzu, who really was foundational to my early thinking about the spirit and the sacred and the soul. And I just dug into that realm. And then I had this talent for science, you know, and it psychological science, although a lot of it isn't really that, you know, oriented towards these questions, it gave me these kind of this broad sense of, wow, like if you could study collective mind, what an amazing thing to study. And then, you know, some people would write about it with literature. I couldn't do that, but I was like, could I just think about a scientific study or statistics could help us do that? So I think in some ways, my parents set me on a path really well. They gave me big questions to think about and then a direction.
Yeah. This is really helping join some of the dots because I sort of immerse myself in someone before I talk to them. And there's often things I'm puzzling over. And with you, it's been
really
how
nice.
Unlike an academic you seem.
I know.
I think a lot about formation, which is this Jesuit concept, but basically just means that who we're becoming, and who we're becoming is such a product of the relationships we're in and the forms of attention that we apply and the sort of repeated habits and rituals and, you know, the classic phrase is no formation without repetition. And so particularly academics and scientists in the sciences, we can talk more about this because there's a lot of getting into your work. I'm like, so much I want to talk to you about. But the formation of academia and the sciences, of which I have many people who are dear in my life who have gone through that, but they don't tend, they read differently from you and sound different from you. And so I'd just love you to say a bit more about that. And have you felt like a bit of an outsider or an anomaly in some of the tribes you found yourself in professionally?
Yeah, I don't think I ever have found a tribe, you know. I do feel like an outsider in the fields I'm in, even though our science has helped start, you know, various subfields and the like. I think my parents taught me to, you know, and this is the spirit of the late 60s, to watch out for institutions and distrust them. And especially authority figures. Like, you know, both my parents struggle with authority figures and they're an artist and a literature professor. And so when I And, you know, when I get into systems, I look at them and I'm like, oh, there's the bureaucratic structure and there's the person who's the president and talking like the president and all these roles they play. And I just wasn't raised like that. You know, I was raised in the spirit of romanticism in many ways, like follow passion, follow curiosity, follow awe. And so that's always been true of me, you know. And then with respect to science, I, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with Michael Pollan about his forthcoming book on consciousness and how, in some ways, the humanities do a better job of the deeper questions, right? Consciousness, spirit, you know, awe, if you will. But I'm in a scientific tradition and that's what I was good at. And so I've always gotten my hypotheses and ideas of phenomena from literature and paintings and music and the humanities. And I was raised in that way. And so I'm sort of a translator of the humanities in a way, and people, that makes me weird, yeah. Right? I study weird things. So, and then regrettably, I don't look like a scientist. I look like a surfer, but I don't surf. And I don't talk like a scientist. I can't help it. You know, and I love Iggy Pop and, you know, beat poetry and, so that's what I got, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, it's clearly part of the reason that so many people are able to kind of hear what the findings that you're bringing from your field externally. The other thing I wanted to ask, and bear in mind, I am married to a philosopher who I adore, but one of my bugbears with philosophy is it's supposed to be love of wisdom, right? But there's this run, I don't know if you've seen The Good Place, but there's this running joke on The Good Place, this Netflix sitcom about the afterlife that you might quite like, where there's a ethics professor, and there's this running joke about everyone hates ethics professors because they're terrible people. and my instinct, there's a lot of people that study the good life, you know. And I have a friend who's an anthropologist, and someone invited him to a big religious ritual, and they said, don't come as an anthropologist, come as a person. Like how easy it is when we study something to maintain analytical distance and write about it, but never apply it to our own lives. Have you found that risk? How have you overcome it? Tell me a bit about that.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's... you know, I've taught science of happiness for 25 years to, you know, tens of thousands of people now. And some of the lessons of happiness I struggle with. You know, I do, there's a lot of anxiety in my family. I had 4 or 5 years of like, I had more panic attacks than have been experienced by the average auditorium of 200 people. So, you know, the idea of just like savoring the joy of today and feeling grateful for everything. And, you know, it was hard won for me to apply those lessons, some of the classic lessons of happiness. And then I got to awe, you know, and meaning. And I think the happiness literature, you know, and thanks to people like you, are looking deeper, right? Like what's beyond pleasure? What's beyond the healthy romantic partnership? What is awe about? What's meaning about? What's the transcendent? And when I got to that, and that's why I had to study it, Elizabeth, you know, I am a child of awe. My parents were giving it to me. And I had these tools. My colleagues kind of laughed at me, but I was like, this one felt like it spoke to me with ease personally, you know. But it's been, there are parts of it, you know, optimism, like for one of the big first stories in the science of happiness was just be optimistic, you know, and I'm hopeful and I love human beings, but I look at what's happening and it's like, well, let's be optimistic about American politics. Come on, you know, give me a break. So I struggled in applying it and that was ironic, you know, to get in front of a class and like the keys to happiness. And now I tell my class, like, you know, I come from an anxious genotype and I've had more anxiety than most of you and it's okay. You know, we can find our way in it. But getting to awe and meaning and narrative and art has been a transition in being able to apply it readily, what I learned in the lab.
Okay. Well, I want to finish by talking to you about religion as a way of structuring applying to this. But first, let's stay with you for a bit longer because I want to hear What is it? How do you define it?
Yeah, you know, awe is, you know, we have a lot of research now that says there are about 20 distinct emotions that shape how we perceive the world and relate to people and construct our cultural realities. And awe is one of those 20 emotions. It's a brief feeling you have when you encounter things that are vast or beyond your frame of reference, right? Oh my God, look at the colors in the sky, or these leaves fluttering in the wind, or, you know, the magnificence of some of Jane Goodall's, you know, kindness and insight. And then awe is mysterious. You can't make sense of it immediately. Like, what is this? You know, what is this painting about? I don't get it. So awe is a feeling we have when we encounter vast mysteries. And then a lot of our research suggests it unfolds in this wonderful way where we feel humble and open and small and connected to vast things, which is where we began our conversation. You know, when you feel awe, I remember in writing the book, feeling awe suddenly in a moment at this experience of a symphony, which I was struggling to understand. And it suddenly made me realize that the symphony was about, you know, this vast theme in life of subjugation and encountering vast forces that are beyond us. And I had this powerful feeling of like, wow, I'm relating to this idea in music. So awe is an emotion that helps us connect to the vast forces of life.
Yeah. It's making me think, bear in mind, I do not quote Kant very often, but the only bit of Kant that I've ever really read is his kind of aesthetics and the concept of the sublime. And I remember struggling to understand what he's saying and getting the sense that the sublime is kind of yourself reaching up to understand and then sort of falling back on yourself because you can't. And it's quite scary, right? It's quite destabilizing of your sense of self. Is that in there too?
It is. I mean, you know, and what we know is we navigate the world through the lens of what I call the default self. Like, what are my goals here? Am I satisfying my needs? Am I rising in status? Classic self-ego concerns. And then there are these realms of the imagination where we suddenly understand we're part of something larger, right? We're part of a cultural tradition that transcends the self. We're part of evolution, in my view. Or a musical, the meaning in music and awe connects the self to those large things. And yeah, we're always oscillating between being part of something transcendent. Wow, I'm part of a political movement. It's so thrilling. And then, oh, I have this individual self I have to take care of. And it is destabilizing very often. It's a great word.
Unselfing is what Iris Murdoch calls it. I really loved your book and your... But the thing that really stuck with me was, you know, there's that we get all in these, in music and the arts and creativity, all these things that I sort of expected and in nature, but most commonly actually in interactions with other human beings and particularly in moments of this phrase you use, moral beauty. And I'd love you to say a bit more about that because clearly you're extreme, you know, a lot of the time you're referencing evolutionary forces and my kind of mother tongue dominant frame is theology. And so when I think of moral beauty, I think, you know, no greater love is this than they would lay down their life for their friends. You know, that kenotic, self-emptying love that's so part of the story of my tradition. How do we explain those moments of moral beauty within an evolutionary frame? Do we even need to? Just help me understand a bit more about what those mean to you.
Yeah. What a wonderful... frame for the question, Elizabeth, and your quote gave me chills, which is a moment of moral beauty. The idea that we lay down our lives for friends. It surprised me too. You know, we studied 26 different countries or cultures, radically different cultures from Mexico to India to China. We asked them to write stories of awe, and the most common story was moral beauty when we are awestruck and we tear up and we get lumps in our throat and we get the chills in encountering people's courage and kindness and overcoming. You know, I see the protesters on college campuses today and I'm filled with moral beauty that they are introducing a new political concern for our times, young people. We're overwhelmed by people's capacity for selflessness. And it's descriptively true. A lot of people have written about this, from David Hume to Immanuel Kant to the great ethical traditions. I was just talking to NASA scientists, and I asked people to give stories of moral beauty. And this space scientist said, you know, he volunteers in prisons as part of his religious tradition. And this religious leader went in, he had Parkinson's, and as part of the ritual, the visit, he would wash prisoners' feet. And we all started weeping, right, in the spirit of Jesus. Like, wow, think of what humans do. And it's everywhere, despite our cynical times in many ways. And why we need that evolutionarily is very simply, and there's new philosophy around this suggesting the deepest way we find our moral compass is through moral beauty, by, you know, hearing that story of washing a prisoner's feet. I walk out of there like, I've got to care for people who don't get the breaks I got, period. That's a moral principle I need to live by, which I want to. And I learn it not from a text or deep analytical study. I learn it in the reverence for human beings. And I think, man, do we need that right now? You know, 40% of American kids can't name a role model. You know, they can't say, I love Malala or Mother Teresa, you know, or, you know, LeBron James when he speaks on behalf of Black Lives Matter. So it's so powerful. It's the way we learn how to be moral beings, which our hyper-social species fundamentally needed to get our children to be raised to the age of viability. So it's foundational to our culture.
Yeah, it's so interesting how much everything comes back to relationship and connection.
Yeah.
I want to put a theory to you, which is entirely untested and completely
great,
intuitive on my part. And it is in this series we're theming around the book I have coming out called Fully Alive. And the chapters are very loosely framed around the seven deadly sins as a way of thinking about disconnection, which is my definition of sin. Mm. We disconnect from our own souls, our own selves, from each other, from the gift of the created world, and obviously in its most common understanding, from divine love. And in my chapter on gluttony, I spend the first half thinking about addiction and addictive and numbing behaviors and the way we disconnect from ourselves by distracting, numbing, not listening to the things we really want, you know, which is usually comfort and to be affirmed and to be in intimate relationships with other people and to feel safe and to feel known. You know, these deep relational needs, which is, I do stuff them down with doom scrolling or online shopping or booze or food or whatever it is. And I have very deep love of the recovery movement and the wisdom that is in there. But their answer to a lot of that is sobriety, which I'm like, yes. And, or like something about ecstasy, the transcendence, these moments of unselfing. I have a kind of very strange, charismatic Christian Pentecostal practice that still feels very important and very life-giving to me. But I realized I was making this argument in the book that I do not know the field at all well to know if this is something that feels like it's just true in my life or whether there might be a broader experience. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. If I understand you correctly, Elizabeth, I mean, I think this it's a profoundly important hypothesis you're offering, that, you know, the key to dealing with things like addiction, which is widespread, in the United States.
And I mean that in a very broad way, something we're all complicit and caught up in.
Overeating and, you know, drinking too much alcohol, you know, smoking, et cetera. Those are hard habits to kick, really hard. And then you might even add, you know, trauma, like the hijacking of the mind by trauma. And maybe the pathway to healing is through awe and transcendence, you know. And that's been sort of an animating idea in our lab, and we've published work on this, that why awe is good for, you know, we took veterans rafting for a half day, and they had a 32% drop in PTSD symptoms for a week. right? That's powerful to do half a day of something to take a third of PTSD away from someone. And so I think it's a cutting edge hypothesis that maybe what we should be orienting therapies toward, addiction approaches toward, you know, trauma treatment toward, is getting people to find the vast things they're connected to, their connectedness, like you said. And that's such a radically different view of the typical Western European view of like addiction is some dopamine malfunction in the brain. Depression is a serotonin malfunction. We now know that's not true.
Yeah.
And so I think we got to be looking to this deeper connectedness that you're talking about. I think it's really, I hope the work lives up to your thinking.
Yeah. Well, it was just through talking through a lot of people. I had a lovely conversation with Nick Cave, and Nick Cave talks about the similarity between the thing he was looking for in his heroin addiction and the thing that he's interested in church is depth.
Yeah.
Is, you know, William James calls it the more. And it's right there in the recovery stuff, right? Jung talks about, he's writing about it early on, about the God, however you understand them, and whether it's removable or not. And he was like, he talked about spiritus contra spiritum, that the Latin for alcohol and the Latin for spirit it's the same word essentially, and that we need spirit in order to, you know, sate the craving for vodka. And it's a hard thing in a culture that doesn't know how to talk about spirit and is scared of spirituality, and for some good reasons very cautious about religion, right? To say actually it's a metaphysical yearning that you're trying to sate with consumerism or workaholism or an eating disorder or whatever it is.
You know, you're heading into such, and I'm embarrassed I haven't thought about this as much, but you're offering a really deep scientific idea in the social sciences.
No one's ever said that to me before.
Well, in the social sciences, we're reconceptualizing what needs humans have. And so there first was a paper on the need to connect and belong. And then my collaborator, Cameron Anderson, said, we have a need for status and respect. William James, the deepest urge we have is to be appreciated. And you're pushing it and saying, we have a need for connecting to the transcendent, right? To spirit or, you know, transcendent music, et cetera. And I agree. I think that for me, human evolution built into us this capacity to connect the individual self to large systems out in the world, an ecosystem, a cultural system, a family system, a spiritual system. And that probably neurophysiologically has the structure and function of need, right? Which is, I hunger for this. It involves, you know, the vagus nerve and oxytocin and a lot of neurophysiological systems that when satisfied feels fulfilling. And I think today, when I look at young people and hear about the meaning crisis and the health, mental health crisis, to me, it's that they're not connecting to larger things to guide their lives, what some people would call spirit or soul or so.
Yeah. I think it was originally at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, self-transcendence, and that it often gets translated in the literature without it. And he has very interesting things to say about religion and ecstatic experiences and what they mean. But anyway, I won't go into that. So I want to land with that question really about how we create the structures for these things. And one of the cases that I'm making in the book is I am both a Christian in the sense that I believe it, right? It's not just an instrumental exercise for me. I think there's truth in that. And I have also, having been in it and then out of it and then in it again, have come to see the sort of deep psychological insight that being part of a religious tradition in the healthy forms, huge caveat, can bring us. That these actually insights like how important we need awe, and you've written elsewhere about compassion, and I didn't get to talk to you about the power principle and this amazing thing about the more power and privilege that we have, actually the harder it is to sustain a healthy character.
Yeah.
And I think that I write about that. There's something going on about the way money works and power and relationship and the need for interdependence, and power and privilege takes you away from interdependence, and you cannot be fully human if you're not interdependent. That I've basically landed right back in. I don't know how you do it without religion. I don't know how you do it without communal, robust, ritualized, imaginatively embodied spiritual pathways.
Yeah. Yeah.
But religion could also be the worst thing in the world when it goes wrong.
Yeah. As the atheist.
Talk to me about it.
Yeah. You know, religion makes people happier. Religion makes people healthier. Religion makes people less vulnerable to major episodes of depression. Those are robust empirical findings. And then you have this, and of course, you know, as the Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and others have observed, you know, 20 years ago, religion leads to wars and, you know, it's causing turmoil on our college campuses here. So it's a complicated thing. It's part of our human history. And what I'm interested in as a psychologist is that, you know, is young people around the world are moving away from religion. Attendance is plummeting. Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times called it the de-churching of the United States. That's true. And then at the same time, the people are creating paths, spiritual paths, through alternative means. They are meditating like never before, yoga studios, etc. You know, and so what I have pursued, both personally, I'm not a religious person, and then in my teachings of a de-churching population, is find what's great about religions and build it into your life. Find your rituals. Find your ways of having, you know, periods of quiet and reflection. Find your pilgrimages. Find the music that is sacred to you. Find the iconography that matters to you. You know, for me, it's posters of Iggy Pop. You know, so, you know, we can rebuild with all of those elements of religion. And Nick Cave. I am a deep fan of Nick Cave and admire him and glad to hear his name. That's what we have to do. It's we have a meaning crisis in young people. In some sense, it probably tracks the abandonment of formal religion. So let's recreate it and see where it goes, which is what's happening. And I think we just need to be more intentional about it.
Yes. And this is, so I have various friends who've tried to set up non-religious alternatives. Yeah. The Sunday Assembly was one of them. Great experiment called The Nearness. And I've been sort of in advisory capacities to some of those and cheerleading them. But the bit that I'm like, I think no one's quite worked out yet is the communal.
Yeah.
Is the container that holds people together over time.
I agree.
And you know, you talk about connection and relationship and interdependence. Yeah. When we have been formed by a society that says you are an individual and individualize your spirituality, that actually can get us quite away, and it's better and it helps. But that's my open question is, what are the forms of collective and how do people covenant together over time? Because that's how we change. Yeah.
I agree. I think it's the greatest failure of individualism. You know, this cultural form that's so prominent outside of our exploitation and disconnect to nature is we broke ties between people. And that's robustly documented in the social sciences, and we're suffering. You know, loneliness is a disease in some ways. And it's structurally hard to build those covenants and that sense of enduring community. That's the real challenge of this. You know, we can find our rituals, we can meditate, etc., but the community is the deep problem. We've got a lot of work to do. It's really in peril.
Dr. Geltner, I could talk to you for another hour, but I want to thank you very sincerely for your time talking to me for this special Fully Alive series of The Sacred. Well, when I asked Daka what made him feel fully alive, he said connection to someone, something bigger than yourself, which those of you who have been listening along to this series will know warms my heart, because connection is my grand thesis of what fully aliveness is. And I really enjoyed how he talked about justice and compassion as his deep values, and particularly the way justice has come into focus for him later in life after the death of his brother. And he spoke a little about and writes very movingly about that experience. He was with his brother as he died too young. And it was making me think of some episodes we did a couple of series ago, one with Clover Stroud and one with Nick Cave, both of whom have experienced really significant bereavements and write a lot about grief and actually write about the gifts of grief, which is sometimes a hard thing for people to hear because it's not what you would wish on anyone. But given that it comes to us all, it can be really clarifying about our deep values and the kind of lives that we want to live. It was really, just really interesting hearing about his childhood. Unusual childhoods are always interesting. I think that kind of wildness, that outdoor life, that being part of a counterculture with really different values to the culture around you. You could hear how glorious it was to have freedom in nature. It does make me feel this sadness for the kind of sort of screen-based factory farm childhood that we allow too many of our children to have now. But also, you know, he speaks so positively about that time growing up with, you know, really strong values and principles from his parents, but also the way he thinks he was probably protected because he wasn't in his teenage years yet. And those, the drugs and some of the relational stuff that was going on might have affected him differently. He was a bit older. He talked about himself as anxious and misanthropic and snarky as a teenager. And it was just, I think that those people who currently have teenagers might want to take heart, because it's really hard to see in him now. He's so full of, just resonates. He just exudes quite a lot of peace and compassion and kindness. And even if you don't have a teenager, I think knowing that it is possible to slightly reset your temperament, that the people that we find easy to be is not necessarily who we have to stay. That, you know, he's done all this decades of research into happiness and what does it mean to live a good life and how do we find meaning and how do we find awe. And as he said, it's not always easy to apply for yourself. And I'm sure there's days where he's grumpy and snarky and misanthropic still, but that actually we are, you know, we are neuroplastic, we are changeable. It is possible to grow in a different direction. He said, awe is what happens when we feel humble and open and small, and that feels good. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes think about this desire to feel right-sized. We don't want to feel irrelevant. We don't want to feel unseen. You know, we don't want to feel just like a impersonal piece in an amorphous mass of humanity. But also the opposite, you know, the kind of ultra-mensch, the sort of superhuman, homo deus, we can fix things, you know, transhumanist narrative is actually quite, it's too heavy. It feels like it's not what we are designed for. And that's that moment when we feel right-sized, it's very existentially satisfying. And it comes in those moments when we feel our smallness. And it made me think of a poem that I came across on a Substack by someone called Emily Bazalgette. And she quoted this poem by Andrea Gibson, "The Life-Giving Benefits of Befriending Our Mortality." And it has this lovely line, "Awe is the most powerful medicine in the world. I have never felt awe and shame at the same time. If you don't believe me, tell me the last time you saw anything bite with its jaw dropped." And there is something about that last line, you know, that these moments of ecstasy and transcendence, worship in my language, are a posture that is hard to be violent from. It's hard to be dismissive. It's hard to be contemptuous. It's hard to be anxious, actually. It's hard to be ashamed, as it said in the poem. So we should seek out those moments. And I love the conversation about awe at moral beauty, I do find it difficult to get my head around the kind of evolutionary arguments and where this thing comes from in us about the beauty of self-sacrifice, really. And it's such a strong thread. I was talking to Gretchen, I've temporarily forgotten her name, the famous Gretchen who writes about habits, who I spoke to, about children's stories. And it comes up so much in children's stories, you know, self-sacrificial love, laying down our lives for our friends, this sense of a longing to live lives that are meaningful and beautiful, and that being the highest pinnacle of a beautiful, meaningful life. But how that we don't get taught that at school, right? We're not formed into it. No one says this is how you grow the moral character to be someone who would lay down their life for someone else. All these stories that, you know, that came out of the concentration camps, stories of the saints and the martyrs, both long for those kind of lives, and also obviously are terrified of those kind of lives because it is the ultimate unselfing, the ultimate decentering, you know, the ultimate self-emptying in theological language. Yeah, lots more I want to think about there. And you know what? What a lovely response to me with the, like, literally the world expert on this stuff going, I have this bodged together theory. Which is not just bodged together, right? It's based on an understanding of the philosophy of the recovery movement. And I have some, you know, reasonable underpinning for my intuitions, but it is ultimately just an intuition. And to have him be so open and kind and encouraging and say, you know, that's a cutting edge scientific hypothesis. And I'm going to go away and think about that. Just, yeah, whether he was just humoring me or not, I felt that was terribly good manners on his part. And also encouraging, you know, that it's not bonkers. And then finally, this thing about religion. Both, like many people in the positive psychology movement and in, you know, sociology, being able to say, actually, religion is good for us physiologically, it's good for us in terms of our mental health, and we need it. But sort of alternative for people who can't find themselves in those traditions is this very personalized, you know, Iggy Pop and meditation. All those are really good things. They really can help a lot. But that missing piece, how do we do it together? How do we create communities? How do we covenant with other people long-term, particularly now with the world in the state that it is? We really need each other. We really are going to need each other. How are we going to overcome the bits of ourselves that pull back, you know, that are individualized? I'm getting onto my pride chapter now. But yeah, much more I could say, but we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos. We would love you to check out our wider work. Our production team are Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Amari Gandrin. And we are edited by Drew Hawley. Our music, beautiful music, is by Luke Stanley with vocals by Lizzie Harvey. I'd love you to get in touch. Send me an email. Find me on social media. Subscribe to my Substack. Do check out the book if you have a chance. You can get it from your local library. And I'll speak to you next time. Thank you.